supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, several years ago, journalist Judith Warner set out to document something she'd heard so much about, a growing push by parents and doctors to frivolously medicate children in the name of conformity or achievement or overachievement. Instead, she found that the, quote, myth of the overmedicated child is just that. It's not a reality. Her book, We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, spells out how seriously parents do take their children's mental health diagnosis and describes a hesitance on the part of families to medicate their kids because of stigma or lack of information and very often limited access to mental health care. On today's show, we're going to explore the topic of kids and medications and what parents are doing and what they should know about them. First, I'm joined here in the studio by author Judith Warner. She's written We've Got Issues. She also writes for Time.com and the New York Times Magazine. Judith, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me here.
Later on, we'll talk to psychiatrist Tony Rothstein and pediatrician David Rubin. Tony's active in addressing the non-medical use of stimulants for cognitive enhancement, and David can help us understand the role of medication for vulnerable populations. And we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Judy, there has been this human cry coming from parents, psychologists, social workers. I was part of that, concerned about medicating our children. In fact, in your book, you pointed out that the incidence of children being medicated is up 30% in the last 20 years, and I even read where it's up 20% in the last 10 years. So what is going on?
There are a number of different things going on. There are a lot of different things going on in different populations, as I know Dr. Rubin will discuss later in the program. And it's a complicated story. And the problem is that journalists like me have done a very good job of boiling down this complicated story into a very simple and simplistic storyline that ties into a lot of other bigger worries that we have right now about parents and children and our society at large. And unfortunately, I think what's gotten buried often in the course of streamlining and simplifying the story of kids and meds and psychiatric care and parents is the sense of these children and their parents as real human beings.
At the same time, kids are being medicated more than ever before. And it does raise the question in my mind, why? I mean, are kids having more difficulties than before? And I have to tell you, Judy, my experience early on, I was part of the human cry and seeing kids medicate. I mean, I read the statistics and I was and still am troubled by it. And then over the last 10, 15 years in my office, maybe more, I've seen kids who are more disturbed, more out of control, parents who feel more out of control of their kids and fewer resources than ever before. So there's a lot of things going on here. And I don't want to turn my back on the difficulty with our society or our culture or our quick fix culture, but something is going on with these kids, yes?
And there are so many pieces of that. And I should just step back for a moment and say that I was part of that hue and cry as well.
Yeah.
This book was supposed to be a book about how children were being overdiagnosed and overmedicated, how parents were trying to grab quick fixes to deal with kids who weren't sort of fitting the mold or performing up to the level they wanted them to be performing at. And there was, I think, a definite upper middle class focus going into it in the proposal initially, in the contract initially. The book was given the title of Untitled on Affluent Parents and Neurotic Kids. And I followed that storyline for as long as I could. I wanted very badly to write that book. That was the book I had been assigned. It was the book I was supposed to write. And it was really only after I started looking for statistics, I started trying to read studies that would back up my point of view, started talking to a wide range of doctors, and eventually to parents as well, that I realized that while there were a lot of really valid concerns that those of us who have that point of view have about our society and about what's going on with kids in relation to medication and everything else, that there was more to it than that, and that we couldn't just follow that one storyline. We had to look at it in a more complex way and try to put some of these statistics, some of these numbers about the increase in medication, et cetera, into a specific context.
So you met many people who suffer greatly, like the people in my office. So what were you hearing?
I was hearing of children who really did have problems, and of parents who really didn't want to see those problems in the first place, who tended to have as their first reaction that their kids were being pathologized. If, for example, a preschool teacher brought to their attention that their child was doing something that was just beyond the norm, or if an elementary school teacher said, for example, that a child was having trouble focusing or sitting still or was daydreaming or was, you know, in some way not meeting the expectations. It was mothers who I spoke to, and the mothers consistently felt that the teachers were trying to put their children into a box, and they would resist that. That was one set. Another set of mothers, and this was often mothers of children who were on the autism spectrum, would feel that something was off very early on. Something just wasn't quite right. And very often their concerns were dismissed by doctors early on. They were told they were being too neurotic, too controlling.
We hear that consistently with kids on the autism spectrum.
And, you know, the mothers weren't able to trust their guts, especially if it was their first child. It would be hard to know. They needed help. They needed professional help. They needed guidance. One way or the other, it tended to be a slow and usually a very reluctant entry into the mental health system. The parents I would speak to, if they were at a point where they were speaking to me, generally it was because they had kind of gone through the odyssey of seeking care and come out on the other side to a more positive place. Not all of them had, but most of them certainly had. So these were generally stories that moved in a positive arc. But what was striking to me, especially since I had started out in this position of believing that parents were just eager to drug their kids, was how reluctant, in fact, they were to take that step in particular.
Mm. We're talking with Judith Warner about the question, maybe the myth, of over-medicating children based on a book we've got, Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. Our numbers, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to hear your experience, your concerns, and the good news and bad news about medicating children. Judy, many of us tend to indict pharmaceutical companies here, and they're really making fortunes of money with psychotropic medication and with off-label prescribing, and we're going to talk about that later with our other guests. In addition to that, they're throwing fortunes of money at family doctors and at psychiatrists and even supporting research. I mean, we know about these doctors at Harvard Medical School. I think there were psychiatrists who were sanctioned because of conflict of interest. So what have you learned about the role Big Pharma plays in this?
They've played a pretty nefarious role. I mean, we've got state lawsuit after lawsuit that has been coming out over the past couple of years with states going after pharmaceutical companies for the improper marketing, particularly of atypical antipsychotics, or downplaying negative data or hiding negative data. I mean, we've got a good 10 years now of lawsuits that have been brought against Big Pharma for...
Successful?
Yes, successful settlements, generally, major settlements. And we learned that, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is able to basically factor in the millions of dollars they'll pay out in settlements as the cost of doing business. We've had really important reporting by the New York Times, among other places, looking at payments to doctors or the ways in which physicians allowed themselves to become part of the marketing apparatus of some of these companies. We've also seen important improvements both in legislation and also in the regulations of individual institutions, trying to clean all that up so that the relationships between big pharma and researchers or physicians, individual physicians, moves in a direction of becoming more transparent, which is undoubtedly a good thing. The pharmaceutical industry, to a certain extent, has shot itself in the foot, at least in terms of public opinion, if not in terms of actual sales. Unfortunately, for psychiatrists as well, the actions of a certain number have really cast aspersion on everyone. I think it's going to take a long time for the profession to recover. I think that that was a profession to start off with that people tended to have quite a low opinion of. So it was easy then for them to fall even further in public opinion. I think it's really important that these stories have come out, that this reporting has been done, and hopefully we will move in a direction of much greater transparency and trust will be rebuilt. It certainly needs to be rebuilt. There's reason to distrust. At the same time, what's sad and problematic is that parents feel all the more that they don't want to enter into this sort of pharmaceutical mental health delivery industrial complex. They don't want to bring their kids to a psychiatrist if they suspect there are problems because they're afraid of kind of becoming pawns of the drug companies. And while it's good to be cautious and careful, on the other hand, if it keeps kids who need help from getting help, then it's really too bad.
There are 7,000 child psychiatrists in this whole country. So one wonders about resources and options. An article in the American Psychological Association Monitor very recently pointed out that 4 out of 5 psychotropic drug prescriptions were written by a non-psychiatrist. Is that alarming to you?
It's alarming, specifically in the context of the way general practice happens now, the amount of time that doctors can actually spend with their patients. I think that it's clear that pediatricians are on the front line in delivering mental health services necessarily because that's who parents have access to. There are pediatricians who do an excellent job in doing it and who go out of their way to get extra education, extra training in doing it. The problem is that they are not reimbursed for the time that they spend in addition, let's say, trying to coordinate care with specialists. Many of them are not able to schedule the kind of longer appointments that would be necessary to really do mental health care. They don't have the specific training for it, but in particular, they don't have the time to be able to do it. And there is such an enormous access issue. There are so few specialists. So few of the specialists participate in health insurance in addition. It is prohibitively expensive in many places for parents to be able to get their children the kind of comprehensive mental health services that they need with the kinds of evaluations that they need. I'm sure we're going to get into a discussion later of the overprescribing of stimulants and the too frequent, perhaps, prescribing of stimulants or diagnosis of ADHD. But how many parents can actually afford to pay for the thoroughgoing diagnostic evaluation that children need and which would really cut down on overprescribing? This is a very serious access issue.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Rachel on the line.
Hey. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Rachel.
In this conversation, what I often hear missing is the child's voice. My son has special needs. He is not on the spectrum. And I can remember as we started this journey of trying to determine what was going on and why he was acting the way he was, as early as the age of 5 and 6, my son saying to me, "Mom, I just want to know why I'm different. I want to know why I act the way I do, and I will do what I need to do. He would talk about working and taking medicine if that's what it took, but he wanted to be able to be in control. He wanted to be able to control his thoughts and what was going on for him. And I often hear that missing, this idea that these kids know that they're feeling out of control, just as someone else might if they had a health problem. And they want to be able to feel like their best self, which is a person whose health, and in this case, you know, brain, is functioning in a way that allows them to be a functioning part of society.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, and what you've described is somebody on the spectrum who's pretty high functioning. It's heartbreaking, and in a case like this, what as a mental health professional, what I want from this kid for this child is something that's probably even more difficult to find than a child psychiatrist, is a good child psychotherapist. Now, this is not a medication issue, what she's describing.
What I heard, though, is a child who's really articulate and in touch with his feelings and able to describe them in a way that I'm sure was really helpful in being able to get him good help. And I would just say to that mother that you must have done a really good job in talking to him about what he was going through and what he might expect from life and who he is, so that he was able, even at that very early age, essentially, to be advocating for himself.
Yeah, my grandson's on the autism spectrum. He's now 12, and when he was that age, he was able to verbalize it and explain to his parents what he didn't know. He would say, when his mother made a face, he would say, "Mommy, I don't know that face. I don't understand it." And he's done quite well because of that. We've got to take a break. Our lines are lit up with callers, and I want to bring Tony Rostain into the conversation right after our break. So we're talking with Judith Warner. Like I said, she's just a terrific journalist, reporter. She's written We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. She's going to give a talk tonight about her book and other things at the Irvine Auditorium. We're also going to be joined after our break by Tony Rostain, professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also director of education at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania Health System. Like I said, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking getting harder? If so, you may qualify for a research study focusing on memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 and within 11 years of their last menstrual cycle to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about children and medication with journalist Judith Warner and now Tony Rostain, who's a professor of psychiatry and pediatrics, specializing, fair enough to say, in ADD and ADHD.
Well, I call myself a lifespan developmental neuropsychiatrist, so I actually do work with not just ADHD, but with kids with all kinds of neurodevelopmental problems. I wanted to just make one comment on the previous call.
Yeah, I saw you were jumping over.
So I think the issue of children's voices is critical, and I'm really glad the caller mentioned her own experiences. Number one, any clinician working with children, and especially those of us that prescribe medications, we need to ask the children, what are you feeling on this? Is it helping you? And, you know, what worries do you have and what problems are you having with the medication? I'm also, I really am thrilled to see some new research coming out of England by Dr. Alina Singh, who actually has a cross-cultural study in part through our Scattergood bioethics program. She's one of our board members, which she interviewed over about 160 kids in the UK and in the United States about what they thought was going on with their medication. And one thing she found was that the American kids tended to emphasize that the medication helped them with cognitive ability, with focusing, with doing better in school, whereas in England the emphasis was on behaving better and being, you know, their deportment being more consistent with the expectations. But what her main point is, and this is something that I think Judith's book really is speaking to, is the question of children's authenticity. Are we altering their authenticity by giving them medication? Are we changing who they are as people? And if you ask kids, they don't think so. What kids basically say is it's helping me to be better at who I want to be and am trying to be, rather than it's turning me into somebody else. Now, there were a few kids she did interview, and I could say they're, in my own clinical experience, somewhere around 5 or 10% of kids don't like what they're feeling or feel like it's making them weird, and or they don't want to stay on the medication. And at that point, we don't keep kids on medications if we don't think they're helping.
What about issues of shame? Tony, kids who are...
That's another huge point that Dr. Singh's study points out, and I agree. We're living in a time now where it's still very much a private matter that's become suddenly an issue of public debate. But I remember 25 years ago when we first started our ADD program, a mother had come in with her child, and she was infuriated because even though the child was doing very well on the Ritalin, she went to pick the child up from school, and across the schoolyard, the teacher yelled, you know, has Johnny not taken his medication today? You know, and there were all these other mothers there standing around because he really was difficult, and she was mortified. And other parents have told me about school personnel and others kind of giving them a lot of grief about it. So there's shame, I think, on the family's part. Parents feel shame by the reactions others have. And Judith's book points out the issue of how much we condemn people who make that difficult choice. And the kids, too, are worried about what others think. As it's turning out, though, ADD and being on medication for it is becoming less and less of a big deal in the minds of children today, maybe almost to the other side where it's sort of almost a cool thing, you know. But not quite.
And that's problematic, too. I want to address the issue of how ADD does get overdiagnosed. And I want to talk to the other side of Judy. What you pointed out is when teachers are pointing out problematic kids, parents tend to not want to hear that. But, you know, on the other hand, we're talking about teachers who are not well-trained, who are overworked, have unreasonable demands on them, and certainly in public schools have way too many kids in class and too many responsibilities. And here's a kid who is distractible and distracted and maybe creating problems. And that teacher, I would think, is more likely to want to label that child, have him medicated and back in line to make things easier. Judy?
That is the perception of teachers, and it's the story that people tell. And there has been a lot of fear about it. In the early 2000s, there were efforts at legislation to ban talking about stimulants, but teachers are not allowed to recommend putting a child on medication anyway. And I think generally these days teachers get a really bad rap. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes what I've noticed is that sometimes teachers talk a certain way to parents and parents hear something different than what's actually said. Absolutely. Teachers may say, there's something not right. You might want to get your child evaluated, which they are allowed to say. Parents hear, you're saying I have to put my kid on meds. That isn't necessarily what was said.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's absolutely true that teachers are overburdened, that classrooms are too big, that academic expectations are often unrealistic for younger kids. All of that is true. But I wonder about what goes on in some of those interactions. And I do want to try to not vilify teachers because there's so much of that happening anyway.
So the other thing to point out is that teachers want information and they need resources to help them with managing classroom learning and classroom behavior. And the teachers who are most aware of these difficulties a child is having actually nowadays have more resources than they used to at their disposal. However, cutbacks in funding for even things like recreation and activities that in the day do help kids who are trouble focusing focus better, all of those things are getting pushed aside by the No Child Left Behind, let's test them every minute we can philosophy, which I think is antithetical to children's well-being.
Yeah, mental and emotional health in general. I think the most unnatural thing in the world is to ask a kid to sit in a chair for 6 hours. I mean, ask an adult,
But to answer your earlier question, I think the NIMH report on ADHD in 1999 concluded that it's both over and underdiagnosed, right. And I believe that's still true 12-13 years later. It depends on the community. In some communities, like in West Philadelphia, I still think it's underdiagnosed. I remember going and testifying 20 years ago to city council here about the problem of ADHD in the schools, and then there had been a scandal because somebody had told a council person that her child was being given a medication without her permission and approval, and there was a big witch hunt about it. It turned out that, number one, they could never substantiate that claim anyway. But when I went to testify and looked at the data, it looked like about 0.5% of children in West Philadelphia were getting medication. And if we can estimate conservatively that 4-5% of school-age children have ADHD, that's a really serious under-treating problem. Meanwhile, out in the main line, yeah, kids up to in one mainline middle school, I think they reported something like 18% of the kids were getting medication. Well, I might say that might be more along the lines that the media had been reporting. Maybe there was some overdiagnosis. So I think the real answer to anybody listening is, if you suspect you have a problem or your child has a problem, it's important to get a systematic evaluation done. And that takes time, and insurance doesn't often
and it takes money, and it's heartbreaking that the resources aren't out there.
It takes an enormous amount of money. It takes thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Most insurance won't cover it. The insurance companies that do cover it, often you have to do battle in order to get what you're entitled to. And I think, these mysteries about rates of ADD diagnosis and medication persist. The newest numbers from the CDC now show an enormous range in who's being diagnosed, who's being medicated, but without answers as to why.
And who's diagnosing, too. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Paula. Paula, you on the air? Yeah. How about Joseph? Can we get Joseph on the air?
This is Joseph.
Joseph?
Yes, first of all, I want to tell you that your program has been so helpful to me as a clinician. I'm a behavior specialist. I work with autistic children. And I refer many of my parents to listen to you and to specific programs you've had in the past because you're so user-friendly for parents. And we get technical and things. So first of all, I want to thank you for the programs that you have offered. The second question is, the question I have is, I came here from Pittsburgh about a year ago, and I've been in the autism field for about 9 years. Do you have any suggestions, or your guests have any suggestions, on how do parents who are sophisticated and knowledgeable access qualified medical professionals? My experience is psychiatrists don't have enough training in the clinical side of autism, and pediatricians in the same category, but they have much better handle on children per se. And trying to find well-qualified people or parents who are curious but we see tremendous benefits from appropriately prescribed and administered medications for autistic children. Tremendous difference. So if you have any suggestions, I'd like to hear that.
Well, just, Joe, thanks for your call. And I know that Pittsburgh has a really wonderful program out of the University of Pittsburgh and Western Psych. There is now a consortium of institutions here in Philadelphia, both at the Children's Hospital and at Drexel, that are really working on trying to make resources available to parents. There's a state-funded initiative called the ASSERT Grant. And there actually are, you can go online and there are phone calls to call about, you know, referring for quality assessments and or parent educational sessions. The Center for Autism Research, for example, hosts monthly parent talks by guests from all across the country. So it's changing now. I think the situation is getting better. There are more and more resources. And if you want to just get in touch after the show, I'll be happy to put you in touch with some of those people.
Yeah, and we'll get them on our webpage, too. But Philadelphia is a wonderful resource. Joseph, I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, that was. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I really appreciate your comments about the show. Believe me, I enjoy it as much as you do.
I want you to know that I left an appointment early, so I didn't want to miss this program. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and I hope you don't get in trouble for that.
No.
Take care.
I schedule my own appointment, so I'm okay.
Are we overdiagnosing? I mean, do you worry about pediatricians who prescribe most of the stimulants?
Well, again, you know, of all of the conditions in childhood in which we are now medicating, quote, the mental illness, if you want to call that, or a mental health issue, I think ADHD is probably the one that's been the best worked out and probably the safest in terms of the way it's being diagnosed. You know, every pediatrician now learns how to use the Vanderbilt scale and to really get the basics down. I'm less worried about pediatric practitioners diagnosing ADHD and treating it than I am about the polypharmacy that goes on with kids with a variety of other disorders, the ones that Dr. Rubin's going to speak about later. You know, kids on multiple medications who are given five or six diagnoses and each doctor and each clinician adds a new label to the diagnosis and usually another prescription. So when I see patients coming to see me, usually they've been to see four or five other people, they're not doing well. And generally speaking, what I have to do is not only sift through what's been said before and try to work through with the parents their discouragement with the entire system, but also what we generally start is taking away medications and saying, no, this isn't bipolar disorder, this isn't, you know, a psychotic disorder, NOS. But I think the real problems come in with kids that are either profoundly disruptive and are not responding to what I would call simple, straightforward medication and therapy combined, which is the recommended approach. Mm-hmm. Therapy and medications are just part of the picture. And we have these kids who are very troubled by both unstable environments or schools that can't figure them out, and or problems, real illness issues that are not easily treated. And I think we have to all recognize that the state of the science is still young and there's a lot we don't understand yet.
So speaking of science, I've got to ask this question. Is there any solid research out about long-term effects and we'll start with the stimulants?
Well, actually, Judith mentioned this, that in her conversation with Tom Insall, some of the early studies looking at brain development seem to suggest that stimulants might actually promote brain development, much as we were afraid, because it causes growth retardation in high doses and weight loss. We've always been worried, oh my God, what are we doing? It looks like we might actually, if not hurting children's brains, might actually be helping them, because by being able to focus, they can learn. And the job, I think, of every child's mind is to try to learn as much as they can about the world and to figure it out. So that group seems to be okay. What we don't know are long-term cardiovascular effects.
Yeah.
And what's even more concerning, which we do know, which are in fact right now becoming a pediatric health issue, are what the novel antipsychotics are doing to metabolism and weight gain and diabetes, really. And that group, I think, are the, I call those iatrogenic diseases now. Okay, we're guilty of those. Iatrogenic means doctor caused, and by prescribing, again, with good intentions, and I try my best to be conservative in my approach to use of medication, we see kids putting on 10, 20, 30, maybe 40 pounds in as little as a year. And what do we do then about that weight gain and about their becoming, you know, hypercholesterolemic and hyperglycemic and eventually developing diabetes and hypertension? I mean, what are we going to do with them over a long period of time? We're really worried.
And what you're describing is just what happens to their bodies.
That's right.
When they're overweight that
so way. The answer, just quickly, is we do not know about long-term effects, but what I do know for sure is we don't keep necessarily the kids on the same meds long-term. We try to take them off. We try to modify their regimens, and we try to see if they really still need the medication or not. And that's about it. We're all waiting, and we're hoping that nothing terrible shows up in the long-range studies.
And we know what's going to create long-term benefits is the combination of medication and psychotherapy, yeah. And it's the psychotherapy that's actually going to make changes in behaviors. And so far, we don't know of any negative side effects with psychotherapy. Let's see if we can get another call on before we go to break. We've got Paula on the line.
Negative side effects.
Paula?
With psychotherapy. Let's see if we can get another call on.
Paula's got her radio on. Yeah, I guess we're not going to be able to get to get Paul on the line. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're also going to be joined by David Rubin. He's a pediatrician. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he's an associate professor of pediatrics also at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, we'll be back after a short break. We're talking about medication and children. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking getting harder? If so, you may qualify for a research study focusing on memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 and within 11 years of their last menstrual cycle to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about medication and children. We're going to also have Judith Warner stick with us and Tony Rostain. Judith wrote, "We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication." Tony's a professor at Penn. And David Rubin is now joining us. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Children's Hospital. What's the Policy Lab?
Well, the Policy Lab is, is born from an idea that we weren't taking the evidence that we had on what worked for children and driving it towards action. And so, based out of our own practice experience of our faculty over at Children's Hospital, we hope to create a center where the research that we provided on children would directly engage the stakeholders, be they practitioners or policymakers, to make sure that we were including them early, that we were answering questions that were important to them, and ultimately making sure that the care we delivered was informed by the best research.
You enjoying successes?
I think we are. I like to think that, we're sort of a group of folks where the rubber meets the road. We're really trying to implement novel solutions and really trying to help public systems in particular improve the quality of the services they deliver to, deliver to children.
Well, let's talk about that, because I know that is your area of interest. As a matter of fact, there was an article written about your work in today's Inquirer. I don't know if you were aware of it, but it summarized, it was in the health section, of course, and it summarized your work. So let's talk about that. You're interested in publicly insured children, those mostly on Medicaid. You found that these children have had a 62% increase in the number of Medicaid-enrolled children between 3 and 18 years old that are taking very powerful antipsychotic medications.
Yes, and that's my concern. When I talk about medication, I think I start it in a couple places. One is to say that I'm not someone who believes that medication is not important. It's actually an important treatment option for children. But I think the vantage point that I take is that, particularly for publicly funded children, if they can get access, and that's a big if, these systems are very driven toward the 15-minute med check, and children are prescribed medications in much higher rates than other children in the community. And particularly concerning is this isn't about stimulants or even antidepressants, where you've seen declines in some of those medications. This is about the use of antipsychotics principally to treat some of the disruptive behaviors that Dr. Rothstein was talking about in the previous segment.
So it does beg the question. We're talking about a couple of things. We're talking about seriously disruptive behaviors, and we're talking about publicly insured children. So are children in this population more likely to have psychotic disorders, or are we more likely to give them stronger medication?
Well, I think the challenge for me is that for children, as a pediatrician, I think we try to put a kid in a box who has a behavior. And for children who have disruptive behaviors, we try, if we label them, that leads to certain treatments. And particularly if there aren't other psychotherapies like we were talking about.
Yeah, the grand delusion that the label means.
The label means that the medication should work. And for me, the common route for many children who are publicly funded, whether they're children in the child welfare system or other children living in poverty, is trauma. And we've not been able to figure out a strong approach within these systems to treating trauma in children. And so we shouldn't be surprised about the concerns that we're having about the medication that we're using in children and whether, in fact, they're really helping children's outcomes down the road.
We do know how to treat trauma. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we doing it?
Well, it's been very hard to get to implement the types of programs that are trauma-focused for children in publicly funded systems. And if you look across the board, the best evidence-based programs, you just don't see them very much. We're just starting to develop our own experience in Philadelphia, growing the types of programs in our behavioral health system. And we're fortunate right now to have a very engaged leadership, both in child welfare and behavioral health, who are trying to do that. But it's not an easy lift. Hmm. And many communities around this country and large cities around this country do not offer the types of services that can treat trauma-based symptoms for the children and their parents.
I also think it's important to stretch out the concept of trauma. We've done a couple of shows on childhood stressors, and I'm sure you're familiar with the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experience. And the what we're finding is children who are exposed to ongoing stressors has a devastating impact on them lifelong, and including their brain development. And when you talk about children on Medicaid, we know right away they're living with a stressor. They're living with a financial stressor.
Absolutely. The stressors are numerous. A lot of children are also witnesses to violence and psychological distress. And for me, I think what we're seeing with the use of antipsychotics, whether they be for children in the child welfare system or other children in the Medicaid program, is a real failure of our programs to build the types of therapies that really can help families.
Care. These children need care, and they need some semblance of safety and security somewhere. And my God, I would think we could figure out a way to provide that for them in a way that's cost effective.
I think that the it's more of a long strategy. You know, these are not therapies that you can prescribe a medication in an office visit and see an immediate effect on a child, particularly with an antipsychotic. Let's face it, to some degree, they must work if people are using this. Isn't just about pharma. To see the kind of effects that you want to see from therapy, that takes weeks, months, and so it's a long strategy, and it's been very hard to get folks to invest in a long strategy, whether that's prevention or treatment.
Right, right. I want to bring up a question a caller called in with. She said her daughter's on multiple meds, but when things get bad, she claims they're, quote, not working. Parent, I don't know if it's mother or father, wants to know how to respond. Tony, I'm going to turn to you. My gut instinct is that if the daughter says they're not working, maybe she's right.
Well, of course, and that gets back to this fundamental question, which is to help children, we need to both work with their families and we need to create a community of concern and a clinical care model that allows the child and the family to speak on a regular basis, even in between visits if they're not that frequent, with somebody to say, okay, what's going on here? Now, I do know that in this particular instance, since I don't know enough about the case, I would say, well, maybe the medication needs to be adjusted or certain things maybe need to be changed completely. But it also may be that there's more stress going on. As we know, stress itself makes it less likely the medication's going to work. Okay, so if you're on one medication and then your life is going upside down, it's not likely that, you know, just keeping on the same medication is going to have the same effect. Just like any organ system in the body, you know, your heart doesn't work as well when the day is hot and you haven't drank enough and you're dehydrated. I mean, any part of our bodies needs to be, you know, the changes around us need to be factored in. Mm-hmm. The last thing I'll say is I really think that, and Judith points this out in the book, is that we really vastly need to increase resources for families to understand how these meds work and to be able to explain to them better and to the children better. What are we supposed to get from this medicine and what shouldn't we be expecting? Because I think the other side of the coin is that we're asking more of medication than is fair.
And
okay? That's really my main message.
And parents need to know also what the risk is.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, we can't answer that clearly yet. Let's go to the phones. We've got Joan on the line. Hey, Joan.
Yes, hi. This is Joan.
Hi.
I'm a pediatrician and a parent, and so I really, on two levels, appreciate the sensitivity that all of your participants are using with this issue. I feel like I'm on the front line in many respects. Two comments. One is that I think general pediatricians and probably general family practitioners and also are better at diagnosing and quicker at diagnosing many issues in children, not only autism and autism spectrum and ADHD, but also anxiety and depression, and that we are being, you know, forced to get better at this, quicker at this, and even consider early treatment because so many patients with and without medical assistance programs have limited access to psychological or psychiatric care. The second point is that I think many behavioral problems in kids would be much better served by parenting classes, and I don't actually know of any insurance coverage for parenting classes at all.
What would you hope happen? What do parents need to learn?
Positive reinforcement techniques would be absolutely superb. I spent a lot of time doing things, just simply steering people away from negative reinforcement and more to trying to understand their child's motivation at any age and just trying to guide them rather than punish them out of those behaviors.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if we could find the cure for parental anxiety, I think everything would change in this culture, and that's the underpinning of negative reinforcement.
Right.
You know, it's fear.
Right.
It's fear-based behavior.
But this is a policy issue, you know, that's being raised. Over 25 years ago, Charles Cunningham in Canada demonstrated that having parenting classes in libraries and in schools in the evening and in churches and in temples, that those classes were, A, better attended than clinic visits. Number two, the parents really enjoyed it, and it had an impact on their lives at home. And this was not just instruction, but peer learning. Okay, the parents would describe and help each other out. And this model, it's not new, but why aren't we doing so? Why aren't we making that part of, why isn't every health plan, including Medicaid and the private insurers, saying, yeah, you know, if you're a member of this health plan, guess what? We want you to come to this class right. we're holding. And it, you don't have to go down to the hospital. You can get it in your neighborhood or in the, you know, in the school nearby. And that kind of a, that to me would destigmatize this a lot more, because if we wait for the crises, and this is what I see day in and day out, I see people who are in constant crisis, and they've tried to get these services, and they can't find them.
I'm far from a policy wonk here, but I believe the new health care law, the so-called Obamacare, requires insurance to pay for preventative visits, and so why not mental health preventative visits? We've only got a minute left. Judy, tell us about tonight's presentation.
Well, I guess I'll be speaking more in detail about the book and how it came about and my own story with it and how my own vision of all of this changed and the role that the actual research played then in getting me to a point where I just kind of wanted to get voices of parents and, unfortunately, in the book, to a lesser extent, children out into the general atmosphere so that we started listening more to parents, understanding more of what they were going through and judging them less.
That's kind of the message for the show I've heard today. It really is about listening, you know, that caller in the first segment. It's about listening to children's voices and hearing them. And, you know, we heard from David about the label. That doesn't tell us the story. We truly have to listen to their voices, and that's the message all three of you have given. I want to thank all three of you, not just for coming, but especially for the work you're doing. It's been an important show. We've been talking to Judith Warner, Tony Rostain, and David Rubin. Judy will be speaking tonight at the Irvine Auditorium. Like she said, she'll be speaking about her book. The event is sponsored by the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics of Behavioral Health. And she and I will appear on October 13th at the Overcoming the Odds Conference in Rosemont, sponsored by Devereaux. You can comment on today's show. I'd love to hear from you by going to whyy.org, and you can download our shows on iTunes. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Joshua Rafeman is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer par excellence. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.